Welcome to the Thriving Farmer Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kilpatrick. Our mission is to inspire, educate, and celebrate sustainable farming. We believe that you can build a profitable, sustainable farm that gives you true farm freedom. Join us as we talk to farmers, innovators, educators, and entrepreneurs to glean their top takeaways in business and life. Today's podcast episode is with Audrey Tehan of See the Table Farm in Sisters, Oregon. Now, Audrey runs a small-scale vegetable farm, a couple acres, where she not only provides CSA and farmers market vegetable sales to her local community, but also runs a thriving educational program. And I've known Audrey for a couple years after she joined one of our programs, and we've conversed a few different times, and I have just been so impressed by the tenacity that she shows in her farm and also the heart that she has to educate her community. So you're going to learn a lot in this episode, a lot about how she built and why she built her farm as a nonprofit and the pluses and minuses of that. You'll learn about her educational program that reaches 1,500 kids a year and how she structures that, how she hires for that. And then you just understand how she built her business, kind of how she manages her team, and how they just have fun on their farm. So join me in welcoming Audrey to the podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Audrey.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your farming operation.
Yeah, so I run Seed to Table Farm, and we're located in Central Oregon, which is in the high desert of Oregon. So it's on the east side of the Cascade Mountains. And we're located in a pretty small little town of about 2,000 people in Sisters, which is about 30 minutes outside of Bend, which is a lot larger, which is really nice to have that close by. And I run a 2-acre market garden. We're a nonprofit education farm. So we have two components. Our first component is our production farm. And we have a 2-acre market garden that we're running about 100 CSAs from every year. And then we do also a farmer's market and a small amount of wholesale. And we also donate to the local food banks. And we also donate to the school lunches here in Sisters. And then we also have the other component of our farm is that we have our education programming. And with our education programming, we serve about 1,500 students all throughout Central Oregon. And those students are all involved in a field trip series on the farm where they come out 4 times every year. And they're really getting involved in the seed to table process and going through and learning about science and nutrition on the farm. And all of that is aligned with the next generation science standards with the school. So yeah, we've got a pretty dynamic operation going on here, and we're going into our 7th season right now. So yeah.
Very cool. So give us a little bit about your background. How did you get started farming?
Yeah. So this is my 7th season farming with Seed to Table, and it's my 7th season farming also. I was born and raised on the property that I'm farming on right now, and we raised cattle when I was growing up for a restaurant that we had, for the beef for the restaurant. And my mom comes from a pretty big agricultural background. So we're always outside growing up, helping take care of all the cattle. And but it wasn't really until I got a little bit older, and I always had a garden with my mom. But then when I went to college, I started studying environmental politics and conservation biology, and was able to convince my professors to give me credit to go do willing worker on organic farms down in California, down on a farm in California. And so that was kind of my first taste of working on a diversified vegetable farm. It was about 6 acres in Santa Cruz, California. And I just fell in love with farming in that moment, I think. And just had developed this vision because I had worked a lot with the students and had been doing some environmental education as well, and just kind of developed this vision of being able to start an education program that also incorporated farming. I think for me, some of my passion for incorporating education onto the farm came when growing up, I just had a really tumultuous relationship with food and kind of the realm of eat this and not that, to look like this and not that. And there was a new thing that you should be eating or shouldn't be eating. And when I started working on the farm and getting involved in kind of the local food community, that relationship really started simplifying for me and just becoming a lot more clear, and just started developing this really positive relationship with my food beyond what I had experienced before. And I just really thought that that was such an important part of education that I didn't really receive. Growing up, we had a restaurant, so we ate a lot of food in the restaurant. And, you know, my favorite meal was like canned chili and quesadillas. I loved that so much growing up. And so once I really started exploring incorporating fresh veggies into my food, I just thought that, like, man, I wish that I had like received some education about this when I was younger, and it had really been like mm-hmm. a bigger part of my life. So I just really wanted to share that, and then also just, I don't know if it's my personality or, but a garden wasn't sufficient enough for me. Mm-hmm. And I just really wanted to have that experience also of providing food for people on a larger scale. So
mm-hmm. what would you say your biggest lesson learned during your internship down in California was?
On my internship, I think we just had a lot of fun on the internship, and just the importance of economic viability of a farm mm-hmm. as well. The farm that I was working on, and just how dynamic a farm needs to be. The family that I was living with actually and working with, they had gotten Lyme's disease from the farm. And so they had to like hand it over to managerial staff because their whole family was really sick. And so just like how resilient your farm staff needs to be as well. Uh-huh. Like your land needs to be resilient, but also your systems need to be resilient because you never know what can happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you chose to set up your farm as a nonprofit. Talk mm-hmm. to us a bit about why you did that.
Yeah. So the first couple of years, when I came back, I was given the opportunity to kind of start this farm to school program. I had been involved at the high school here, coaching the girls soccer team and doing some volunteering with the environmental program as well. And so just from communicating with other individuals in the community with what I wanted to do, I had eventually gotten this opportunity to kind of start the farm and had developed this vision and had gotten some administrative support to start bringing students out to my family's property. And so it started very small. It's kind of hard to really like pin down one thing, but starting really small was really great. And we actually started as part of kind of a foundation of the school district. The school district, any school district usually has like a school foundation where donations can be funneled through and other programming can be done under that isn't officially the school district. So we started as a program under the school district, which was perfect because I had a bank account to kind of funnel funds through, and I had like kind of an umbrella insurance policy. And after the first 2 years of kind of discovering like, okay, this is something that I do really want to do. I want to expand the farming operation. I want to expand the education programs. I need to have more staffing. I really came to this like head point of like, okay, do I go the for-profit route or do I go the nonprofit mm-hmm. route? And so with the there's pros and cons that I learned along this whole way working, because I was developing the farm. And so at one point I had funds in the school foundation account. And then I also had to start my own personal like LLC to pay employees under and to have staffing under. And so I was kind of like in, riding this realm already of having this like for-profit and nonprofit farm. And so I just like came to this point and I was like, I need to decide what I'm going to do. Insurance purposes, for structural purposes, and just for decreasing the complexities that were going on in my life around managing all of that. And so I think one thing that I really considered is that there's pros and cons for each. And I think some of the cons that came up from just working under another organization was that it can come with a lot of baggage when you're working for any sort of organization, rather than, you know, that's why so many people really want to have their own business, is because they call the shots at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So that was a little nerve wracking, was is that if you have a nonprofit, you're essentially like, by having a nonprofit, I essentially handed the business over to the board of directors. I have five board members right now, and they are my boss. I could essentially get fired from what I've started. And so that was something really kind of scary and nerve-wracking that I had to kind of weigh into that. And there's also just a lot more accountability that you need to have with a nonprofit, I think, as well, just because you are accountable just with taxes and really where all your donations and your dollars go. So it was just looking to be a little complex. But then when I looked at the pros of having the nonprofit and the support that I had gained in the community from doing our education programs on the farm, it was pretty simple to look at. The amount of CSA members when we started, like, I think we had like 25 CSA members, and most of our CSA members were all new CSA members. They had never done a CSA before, and a lot of their kids had come out to the farm from the school, or they had maybe heard about the program. Their grandkids had been in the program. They had just read about it in the paper, and they really wanted to support the education programming. So to me, like, we just kind of opened up this other big market, and just, I have a lot of friends that also farm here, and that was like a really big that's always a challenge. And the other thing, the other big pro with having a nonprofit component is that you're also open up to having to all of this funding from foundations, from private foundations, from government foundations. And so if I didn't have that nonprofit component, I would be cutting myself off of that funding. And that really, I just view like the nonprofit component as being a diversified component of our operation. I talk to so many farmers now, and a lot of people are talking about diversifying their operation. Rather, I have a friend that has a commercial kitchen on her farm, and you're doing sauerkraut or pickles or agritourism. And for us, our education programs have really become that diversified income from us, because we've been able to contract with the school district to offer our education programs. So at the end of the day, the pros outweighed the cons. And I just also decided that I was like maybe 26 at this point, and I didn't know if that's what I wanted to do forever, but I did know that that's something that I wanted to have continued in the community. And my parents also, it's their land. So they essentially lease it to the organization, but that my parents really wanted to, you know, they believed in it and they wanted to see that continued as well, even if I wasn't doing something. So just having the support from a board also, I don't have a business partner that I'm farming with. And my parents have been incredibly supportive in just they were both business owners as well. So just having so much knowledge about that. But at the end of the day, it's me. And so having other people that I can really rely on and that are also accountable is, it just is really nice to have that. Mm-hmm. So,
And with the nonprofit, I mean, you take a salary as an employee or as executive director?
Yeah, I take a salary as the executive director, also just the economics of it is I was starting to bring in a good amount of money for our education programs and with contracting with different school districts, and having that go away just didn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. So I was able to pretty quickly just develop like a salary for myself, even though it's not, you know, a ton. It increases a little bit every year, but there's just some really great systems that have made the whole process seem more sustainable for mm-hmm. me.
Now talk about the board, the five people that you put on the board. Is that something that you handpicked them and there's a certain number turnover?
So your founding board is the only board that you get to pick. And okay. So, and being on a nonprofit startup is sometimes challenging to convince people to be on the board of. They also take financial responsibility for that organization a lot of times as a board member. I essentially just found, and somebody asked me this the other day, like, how do I find board members? And basically just having started for the first few years, I had a little bit of visibility, and people, you just start to know people and you start to kind of have those really avid supporters that you see in the coffee shop or you see in the store, you see at the farmer's market, or that are in your CSA, and they just like love what you're doing. And like, those are your board members is, and there's not a lot of them that have some extra time, but when I was recruiting a board, I was really looking for people that were passionate and supportive of me and also that had some experience. So I was really fortunate to, when I was recruiting my board, I was able to find kind of five different people, like one person that had financial and a legal background. And I just found, you know, he was a husband of a friend in our CSA. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of scouted out some people. You need like a legal and a financial component. You need a kind of a nonprofit component. You want somebody that's had experience serving on a board. We have like an educator that's on our board. We have a business owner that's on our board. And then we have another advocate in the food and farm world. So looking for like a balanced group of people. And also a board, I think, is a great, I have a friend that owns a pretty successful business in town here, and she just recruited a board for her business, and they don't have any like financial ownership in the company, but it's just an advisory board. And so that's been so helpful to me, just to have an advisory board of people with all these experiences I can call.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the education side. You've leveraged that to do a lot of things. Obviously the education is massive in your community, but you've also leveraged that to bring in new CSA members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The education program has been really amazing. We get so many teachers that call that we can't keep up with the demand for education once people have heard about our programming, which has been really exciting. Mm-hmm. And this year I hired an education coordinator. So I kind of stepped back from the role of teaching and farming and running the nonprofit to just allow somebody else to really focus on that and run it and just focus on that. And it's kind of like doubled in efficiency and in just quality, I think, which is exciting. And expanded our programming. And the biggest thing with that is we have 1,500 kids that are coming out onto the farm 4 times a year. And when kids go do something exciting, they go home and they tell their parents about it. And they love it, and or they didn't like it, but they're
they're telling them either way.
Like, oh my god, she made me eat so much kale today, and I hated it. But they're talking about it, and so kind of slowly over time, you just get that name recognition out there in the community, and we make sure that every student that leaves has something with our name on it. We got a business to like donate produce bags. And so it just says Seed to Table on it. And so when the kids come out and they harvest, they get one of those bags, their food goes in it, and they're taking that bag home. And then the bag is in the house, or they're getting stickers or something. And so there's just like this name recognition. And then you start seeing the kids around town, and like they just recognize myself or staff members. And it was really funny. I was in, we live in a small town, and I was in the store the other day, and I had like hot pink kind of like running tights on. One of the kids was like, that does not look very farmy. I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, oh, like the life of living in a small town. But that kind of stuff is really important, just that recognition around town. And then people also are willing to try the CSA. I think that's like a hard thing for CSA sales a lot of times, is people are, it's a little scary, it's a little unfamiliar. And so like, what is going to make people take that extra step to join your CSA program? And a lot of times it's for them to be a part of something that they believe in. And everybody wants their kid to be healthy. And so supporting an organization that does that is really, you know, at their foundation. If you look at, you know, so many of these larger companies, I don't know if this is a great example, but Patagonia, for example, this is a really big, broad example, but Patagonia, and they have all of these larger initiatives that they're doing. And all of these big companies now are really trying to get their staff members out into the community, volunteering, doing things. And that's like an, you know, that's networking. People want to support other people that are doing good things. And so that's just been a cool way. And people really want to support that. And then they end up falling in love with the CSA. So I put our CSA on sale, and we just sold out of 75 shares in 24 hours.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's I couldn't amazing. Believe that. And that's built up over like 7 years, but I couldn't believe how quickly it sold out. So, and that is just over time from like, we really focus, we are a nonprofit, but we have like a serious production farm that funds itself. The farm is totally funded just from CSA and farmers market sales for the most part. And then, you know, we have a really high quality produce and product that we're outputting as well. So it's kind of this combination that we've been able to really leverage here.
So let's talk a little bit more about the education side. So I'm always interested in exactly how this works. You got 1,500 kids 4 times a year. They don't come in the wintertime. They come twice in the fall, twice in the spring.
They come out 3 times in the spring and once in the fall. Okay. And I guess we have four, like one time we actually go into the classroom. So they're actually out on the farm 3 times, but they have like 4 interactions with our staff. And we go into the classroom in the spring, and we start seeds with them in the class, and we do taste testing and kind of a basic nutrition and seed lesson. And then it just really depends on the grade level, but it's essentially they come out the second time, and then they're transplanting that seedling into like, we have a student bed section. So they're transplanting that seedling, and then they're doing a science lesson and a nutrition lesson along with their like gardening lesson. And then,
And then what kind of seeds are you having them transplant?
Only quick growing ones, because they can quick growing hardy things.
Gotcha.
Because we want them harvesting in June, in early June, and they might plant in April. So they're doing like radishes, beets, usually not carrots, but radish, beets, peas, kale, lettuce, spinach, I think we do about those, like seven, like maybe mm-hmm. Swiss chard. So just really quite simple, hearty things.
Gotcha. And then how big is a class that comes out at a time?
We 30 kids will never have more than 45. Sometimes, like if a school is further away, they'll like combine. If they have three or four classes, we'll do like one and a half class or something. But we'll do up to 45 kids, and then we try and divide them into other groups to only have 10 to 12 students in a group maximum. Gotcha. So I'll have like three, usually an average of three educators on the farm, and the educators are our education coordinator, and then we have an adult farmer training program out west in Oregon called the Rogue Farm Corps, which is an amazing program, and we get two interns from there every year. And so one of our interns will pop in and also be a part of our education program every day. And that's like 2 hours that they're teaching. So it's mm-hmm. not a huge chunk of our interns' time and like our field staff's time. And then I'll have like a rotating, like two or three other kind of educators that will come on, and the educators are parents that showed an interest that want to volunteer, or we'll pay them, or college students, or just anybody that's applied for the position.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. That makes sense. Let's move a little bit more to managing the farm, because you've got a lot of moving pieces there.
Yeah.
So there's always going to be endless tasks to be done. What systems have you set up to ensure you focus and tackle the most vital priorities each day?
Yes, I think that has been challenging, and something that I've been reworking to really figure out where I thrive as well, uh-huh. and where my energy is best spent. I really love and really believe in education, but after the 5 years of teaching a lot, I realized that my passion was really in the farm business aspect and in the nonprofit and like kind of the growth, like uh-huh. the farm efficiency. I love that and really wanted to just have more time to focus on the growth. So really looking at like where I get the most energy from, uh-huh. because I spend so much energy. Obviously we all have tasks that we don't enjoy, and I get out and teach and I love doing that just to stay connected with that. Uh-huh. So hiring like an education coordinator has been huge for me. And I think last year was the first year where I was still working the same amount of hours, but I didn't quite have like this crash that I usually have about September, where
mm-hmm. yeah.
I feel like the world is ending and just get so overwhelmed and I'm so tired. And I actually didn't have that last year for the first time. And mm-hmm. I just wonder if it was because I was able to kind of delegate and also simplify things a little bit. Mm-hmm. And also just be like really focusing my energy where it was really going. Mm-hmm. And then also realizing, yeah, the things that I can replicate or that can be replicated about me and the things that can't be replicated about me. I also realized that, I need to be on the farm. So I'm on the farm in the mornings and in the office in the afternoons. Unless it's the spring, then I'm usually outside all day, every day, or if we have a big day. And just realizing that I've been in Central Oregon for 30 years. And so that my knowledge and just awareness of the environment and of outside and of the farm and the property is not easily replicated. Uh-huh. I think I've had some hard lessons in that, thinking that I could just like hand something off to somebody, even though they were totally capable, but just that there's something that really goes into that awareness. So kind of having those hard lessons about what can and can't be replicated, and yeah, I think and then just where I absolutely have to be sometimes, and then looking at that. And then I also, somebody gave me some good advice that I should value my time at like $100 an hour, which sometimes I am like, I just really want to weed the carrot beds right now.
Yes.
I know this isn't $100 an hour, but I'm going to do it because I want to, and I want to like be connecting with my staff right now. But that thought is really good when I'm have too much to do, and I can kind of look at what I can delegate or what really I can only do for that $100 an hour.
Yeah.
I also got an office, and that has been really nice to have a space that is like a little bit separate from the farm that I can go and I can crank out quite a bit of work now. The office, instead of being at my house or on the farm.
So, a dedicated space.
A dedicated space that feels nice, like a dedicated space that like feels nice and feels professional, and it like, you know, feels clean, and I'll like, you know, change out of my farm clothes and like put something else on and like be like, okay, this is office Audrey now. So I kind of have just dedicating that space.
Mm-hmm. What would you say the hardest thing you've ever done as building the farm business has been?
The second year of starting the farm, I got really, really sick, and I had gotten I had gotten pneumonia, and I got the flu really bad twice. And then I got mono, and I had figured out that, and that was all kind of in the spring. And I had figured out that I was having I just had some like complications with my adrenal glands and was having some other just like health issues. And that was really, really hard mentally and physically. When you farm, I feel like so much of your identity is you're like, I can go out there and I can work so hard. And that was just a lot of my personal identity even before I farmed, was that I could just like go outside and I could put my head down and I could work all day for 14 hours or however long it took. And that was just like really quickly stripped from me.
Mm-hmm.
As I was trying to figure this out through the spring, and I was trying to like do that. And so I just like really quickly had to figure out other systems to put in place and really rely a lot more on my farm manager at the time and on some other staff, and just getting really creative about how I was actually going to get some of the physical labor done when like I was just physically not able to do it. But I was able to spend a lot of time in the office and focusing on systems and education programs and everything. But that was definitely like the hardest thing I've ever done in my farming career.
Well, I think farmers are so physical. And so because of that, you're right. You just get out there and you can put your head down and just get so much more done than many people would ever physically think is possible.
Yeah.
And so to have that aspect just completely stripped away because farming is so physical, you feel almost helpless.
Yeah, it was just really mentally challenging. I had to do so much work I was like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. Do I even want to farm if I can't just be out there kind of like workhorsing it all day, every day, and just really having to ride those fine lines also of being outside and like having to be aware, like I could be outside for like an hour and then I would have to like go back inside and like rest, and just like having to like learn this awareness of my body that I hadn't had to learn before. And I like wouldn't want to go through that again, but I would say that it was a great thing to have happened.
Who would you say your mentors have been over the years as you've been started your farming journey?
Definitely my dad. And because I started when I was really young, like essentially right out of college, and I had worked like one season on another farm essentially. But my parents they both are business owners, and My dad ran a restaurant for 30 years, for longer than that, probably 45 years. And just his knowledge and about business management and about how to get through life when you're really busy and how to manage employees and how to be a creative problem solver, I think has been so valuable. And then also my mom is just like this amazing workhorse. She is like outside every day, all day, like moving irrigation lines, checking this, checking that. And so just that combination in my life has been really, really great. And then I've also built up an incredible network of friends here that farm on our property. My family also leases to another small market garden. And so, you know, just the community of farming has been incredible.
And I think that's something that is incredibly lost because there's not as many small farms. And in the areas that I have seen that, I feel like that's a huge part. Like there's some areas in Maine, which there's like three or four farms in the same property.
Yeah.
And I feel that's an amazing experience and just an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, it's so fun. And it's, you know, we'll have lunch together sometimes, or it's even just like we're doing some tool sharing right now. And then it's funny because we'll have like totally different problems with like pests or something, even though we're literally like 50 yards away. But then also it's like, oh man, like, what are you doing with that problem? Like, man, would you come over and look? Like the, like mescaline didn't germinate very well. And like, what do you think? And it was like last year they were like, oh, it looks like dampening off kind of. And I was like, oh my gosh, I just didn't even think of that in Central Oregon. And
yeah.
So yeah, it's just been really, really fun. And so valuable and so supportive. I've definitely gone over there multiple times to them and, you know, another good friend that farms just crying and like, oh God, killed something. I did something really bad, or this isn't working, or so.
Yeah. So let's say if there was a magic reset button as it relates to starting your farm, what system would you go back and put in place sooner rather than later?
A heater in our propagation house.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially here. I can't believe that this is our first year that we've had one. And I just can't believe that we haven't done that.
Gotcha. So before that, would you just starting seeds later or just blankets or?
We had a very complicated system of, we used rope lights.
Okay. Yeah.
From like Home Depot under the mats. And that worked fine for, you know, like 4 years ago. And we had, you know, remate and then a layer of plastic over that too. So like low tunnels within the propagation house.
Yeah.
But, you know, we had like 20 extension cords running around and we were always blowing the fuses and blowing the breakers and just like, it just wasn't consistent. And then we'd have to go in and you'd have to open the small hoops and close the small hoops like multiple times a day. It just like wasn't consistent temperature, but it worked. It worked, but it was finicky and probably dangerous with a lot of electrical cords and water. And so I'm excited about that.
Very cool. All right. And with that, I'd like to stop and take a quick break. In a minute, we will be back with Audrey Tehan from Seed the Table Farm in Central Oregon. If you've been enjoying this episode so far, you're going to want to head over to growingfarmers.com/free resources and download our free resource bundle to help you shave hours off your week and become a thriving farmer. It includes resources such as our 10 winter growing secrets we wish we knew when we started, which is a ebook which talks about the tips and techniques to get better growth in your winter production. We teach things like the simple but counterintuitive principle that trips up most beginning growers, the shape and size of tunnels that are best for winter production, how to prepare beds so they are weed-free and get beautiful, lush stands of crops, what to do about pests like aphids, voles, and slugs, how to fast-track your research to fine-tune your production for your microclimate, and how to pack in more crops for higher yields and profits. So head over to growingfarmers.com/free resources and download your free resource bundle today. Hey, Thriving Farmers, Michael Kilpatrick here. So I wanted to make you aware of a free training series that we have coming up here starting on Wednesday, February 26th. So you're going to want to go to www.growingfarmers.com to grab your free ticket. And this training is all about marketing and farmers markets. So if you're just starting out at farmers markets, if you've been in that farmers markets for a long time, if you are frustrated with farmers markets and trying to figure out if you need to continue them or get out or try a different marketing channel, this is the training you want to attend. And we only do it twice a year, so make sure to show up. So past attendees, like Michelle said, we tried a totally different way of displaying at market after your training, and things are flying off the shelf. Padges said, try to add the things you talked about. People loved our display. And Matt says, 67% increase in sales over our best day yet. All right, so how do we do this? What do? We help you sell more without overwhelm and complication. If you listen to our podcast or watch our live trainings, you know that we offer serious value, and that's what this is all about. So in this series, you'll learn how to pick the right greeting that'll pull people to your stand, how to use promos to call attention to your products and move excess product, how to position yourself in the marketplace uniquely so that you bring in a tribe of raving fans that is going to help you grow your brand, grow your business. So you're going to want to go to www.growingfarmers.com. There'll be a great big orange button at the top of that page for you to sign up and grab your ticket, your free ticket. Remind you, it's all free, and to come join us in this exclusive training. All right, we are back with Audrey from See the Table Farm in Central Oregon. So Audrey, talk to us about team. How do you divide roles on the farm?
Yeah, so this has evolved over the years, I guess, which it will naturally do. And I think it's really important. A couple of years ago, it's really easy, I think, just to keep going year by year, just keeping doing what you're doing. And for us at one point, it was like, okay, we actually need to sit down and we need to define our roles and like everything. And we sat down, my farm manager at the time and I sat down with an individual in the community that like did this for other businesses. And we hashed out between the farm manager and between myself, like the executive director and farm director, like what those roles were, especially in terms of managing employees. Because it was getting sometimes a little, there would be some overlap or some just like different things said to different people.
Different opinions.
Or just like that I would say one thing and then somebody else would say another thing just because we hadn't communicated on that before. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so we just really tried to like hash out what our roles were. And this was actually a really challenging process because it's like anything, like what you write down on paper and what actually works in real life and in the field is always going to be changing. And so you definitely need to be... the team, like as you start developing this, needs to be, you know, you need to be flexible and you need to revisit it and you need to be humble and you need to just realize that it's kind of a living document, I think is important. But so I guess right now you could like think of it as a triangle that like I'm kind of at the top as the executive director and the farm director. And with a nonprofit, with a board of directors, so the board of directors is above me, and the board of directors is only supposed to have contact with the executive director.
Okay.
So they don't do any overseeing or any managing of your employees. That's like a big no-no between like board of directors and executive directors.
So it's almost like an hourglass.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. That would be better. Hourglass rather than triangle. Yeah. So then you get to like me, I'm the executive director and the farm director. And then under me, we have our like assistant farm director. Uh-huh. And then we have our education coordinator is on the other side with our two programs there.
Gotcha.
And the education program, and then Ode, our education coordinator, she might have like three or four different kind of very part-time people she's looking under or that she's managing for field trips. And then on our farm side, under Madeline, our assistant farm director, we'll have our rogue farm corps interns and any volunteers under
gotcha.
That.
Gotcha.
And that is a really important structure to maintain. And I've talked to other individuals as well that, and I've had to learn how to maintain that structure. Just if you're the farmer and you're involved with everybody and you are seeing things. And for me, I'm such like a verbal thinker as well and a processor. And so learning how to draw the boundaries, like we developed with our assistant farm director, we developed with our employees, there's a saying like, if it's an inside of the fence question, then you go to Madeline or our assistant farm director. And it's if it's an outside of the fence question, then you go to Audrey. And so, and Madeline and I will have communicated before we're meeting with our other employees. So like, it's kind of going, the information is going, okay, Madeline, this is how I want this done. And we had a staff turnover last year. So it, you know, we had to practice this system a lot last year where uh-huh. Madeline and I would make sure that we met before we met with like the entire farm team. And so then we're like, okay, this is how we're going to do, this is how together we're going to tackle this task. This is the roles that we're going to do. And so we were on the same page as that. And then if people had questions, then I would have to learn how to like kind of direct that back to Madeline. Like, oh, that's an in the fence question. So, mm-hmm. you know, ask Madeline. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the education side, how did you hire those team members?
For our education coordinator, I mean, we just put out a job description. We put out a, you know, a call on mm-hmm. a bunch of different sites, and we're really fortunate to find somebody through that was close to us. I found that that is kind of important for mm-hmm. for hiring, is to hire somebody that has some sort of connection to where we're at, family member, friends, they've been here before. And so she came from just like a town 2.5 hours away in Corvallis and just seemed to be a great fit. She had worked a lot in the educational sector and just has been an incredible asset for us. So mm-hmm. it's kind of using those networks.
Yeah. Yeah. So I also see you guys have a lot of fun, it seems like, as a team on Instagram. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What strategies have you implemented to bring on the right kind of just local team members? I know you've got two, you said rogue farm interns as well.
Yeah. I think one thing that I've really done with like developing our team is really sitting down with like another individual that has done hiring for other businesses for a long time and really developing a set of really good interview questions. Mm. And so I have these kind of like standardized interview questions that I really like that kind of can also give personality. It can let people kind of know my personality and the personality of the farm a little bit. And also I can get to know somebody a little bit better. Uh-huh. So I think that's been really important, is to develop those interview questions. And I don't really know how we manage to have so much fun, but we do it. I just really try and keep things like pretty fun and relatable and have uh-huh. good boundaries. I try and make sure that things are, the expectations are known. And so that those are easy to refer back to. And, you know, this is, I try and do my best and I mess up all the time on it. but so that when you're having a lot of fun and you kind of get when something needs to be addressed, that there's something to refer back to. Like, remember, these are our guidelines for harvesting that we talked about. It's these. And so then it's not like a personal attack, you know, just trying to have systems in place that you can kind of protect yourself as an employer, just to have kind of better communication and expectations laid out for people from the very beginning. And I found that that keeps it nice and helps to diffuse stress or problems when they come up, and kind of keep away from getting personal.
So do you have an employee manual then?
Yes. And that is increasing all of the time. But I do have an employee manual. We partner with Rogue Farm Corps, and they have an incredible system for managing interns, and they have an incredible employee manual that we use. And yeah, I just have really clear job expectations. That's been one great thing about having the nonprofit, is that you have to have these things when you're applying for grants and you want to apply for a grant for an education coordinator. You have to have a really detailed outline description of everything that person is going to do. So I'm having to think about these things all the time. I'm having to report back to my board on, this is our farm director, this is what they do, this is the pay, it's comparable to other pays, da, 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 da. So that's been really good, because that's also not my strong point, is being overly organized. That's something I've had to work on. And so having other people that I'm accountable to has really helped me in that realm. The other thing about like why we have so much fun is I think that we do a really good job of staying pretty balanced, and that I really try and have a good balance of work and staff and not taking on too much or offloading something when it's, or bringing on another person part-time to relieve people. You can like really tell during those times of the year when just like people are really tired, and like it might seem like you can't possibly give them a day off or something, and everybody kind of tanks at different times during the year. And so I just try and keep like a really good tab on people and their self-care, and really try and promote self-care and really ask people about what they're doing for self-care a lot. And if people are really looking really tired, it's just like, hey, why don't, you know, go take like the half a day and just like, you know, rest. And I better not see you out and about on the town tonight.
Yeah.
Resting in your trailer.
Yes.
So, I think that is also how we've been able to kind of keep our morale up.
Okay. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Let's move a little bit to the marketing side of things. And it sounds like you don't really have a problem with this, filling your CSA in 24 hours, but I think you said that the education side really just feeds the CSA, filling the CSA, but you also do farmers markets. So talk to us a little bit about why you do that.
Yeah. So I guess just, I'm really inspired again on the business aspect of the farm. And I think that's why our nonprofit, so many nonprofits fail because they don't have a solid financial, they don't have diversified income. Basically, it's the same for a lot of different businesses as well. Like you're only relying on certain grant funders, and then those grant funders, that's not sustainable. Grants only fund you for like 2 years, and then they want to fund a new program. And so it's not like a magic thing that happens. Like you can't just get a nonprofit and then apply for these grants, and then all your problems have gone away because you're all of a sudden getting all this influx of money. It's like a pretty diversified dance with your funding. And so just that recognition that for us, the most sustainable way to like continue our farm is to be making money on our farm, and to have that reputation of not only as a nonprofit, but we have a really strong reputation is just having a really amazing CSA. I was fortunate enough that like one of our very first farm managers that worked here had worked on a couple different farms before me and, or before she came and worked for me. And those farms had like, were in San Francisco and they were competing in this market. And so they had to have this incredible high level of quality. And so she like helped train me on what that even means. And so that's been something that we really try and uphold as well. And just really try and improve on is that quality and consistency. And just the marketing, yeah, the built-in marketing plan is our education and our community outreach plans. And
which you get paid for.
which we get paid for, and we do a lot of extra stuff to get out there. If there's events in town that that there might be the right mix of people at, we're going to want to be at that event. We're going to want somebody at that event representing Seed to Table and a lot of networking. So I've put in a lot of time getting out and about and just spreading that reach. And also we've done, you know, I keep people up to date and I do a lot of writing. I think that's also a really big part of our marketing plan is we have a local newspaper here and I try and write an article for them multiple times, probably like at a minimum once a month, but like twice a month I try and get an article in there in the paper and just really try and tell our story. And I'm constantly trying to get better at telling our story in the paper, in our newsletter. I'm really working on building our newsletter all the time. I'm asking people like, what's your email? All my staff members are kind of trained that if they meet somebody to, you know, ask them if we can add them to our email list, and that everybody is out and about. When you live in a small community, you also learn that you're like every interaction really matters, whether you think that you know that person or not. You know, just like an example would be when I was growing up and my dad owned the restaurant and somebody wouldn't even know me and they would make like an off comment about how they didn't like some of the food or something.
Yeah.
At so-and-so restaurant, and then not even knowing that I was the daughter of the person that owned the restaurant, you know, and just like every interaction, like really matters, I think, in your community when you own a business. And so my staff is just also trained just that. And I think that that helps a lot, that we're, everybody's trained to tell our story. I'm telling our story in the paper. I'm like really digging deep to like find those connections and to try and connect with different people. So it's not just like a poster type of, you know, we're not putting our posters out there. We're really trying to get people to like buy into our story, which I know a lot of people are trying to do. So.
But that whole paper aspect seems like it's getting in front of them multiple times a month. And so what kind of, are you writing in the article? What kind of topics are you trying to cover?
It depends on what I feel inspired about. I've also found that that's one of like the most important things is to, I have a friend that she runs a farm and I feel like every time we get together, we're kind of digging deep and she's just is really inspiring to me. And so when, you know, I try and like take some notes on those conversations or just whenever I have like a little hint of something that's inspirational or that hit me within our food system. So it can vary from like gardening tips. People love that. Farming tips or like farming history of Central Oregon or soil science in Central Oregon. Then it can range from like my personal experience with food and agriculture to I think one article that I wrote was on like global agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So just really, you know, all over the place, but just trying to get out there consistently, makes a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you feel is the biggest mistake that beginning farmers make?
I think what like first comes to mind for me is not investing in technology that will make you, or maybe not technology is the correct word, but in equipment that will make you that much more efficient at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to have everything, but really identifying, like for us, like a heater in our propagation house is just like, we live in Central Oregon and we had, you know, feet of snow on the ground until April 1st last year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a huge step for us. Like we just got a quick greens harvester. And we just upgraded our irrigation system, which saves us so much time. And so I'm like, man, I wish that I had just kind of, and I didn't know about any of this because I didn't have any farm training at the beginning, but
yeah,
there's so much stuff out there now that really trying to like get a small loan and not just trying to start the farm on like the very, very bare minimum and just trying to like get some investors or borrow some money to, you know, to spend that extra 10 grand on some equipment at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Actually, just before I got on with you, I had someone messaging me about the 5-row Jang. They're like, do I need that? Do I need the 1-row? Where's the best way to get it from? So you're right. That equipment, it makes you so much more efficient compared to using an earthway seeder, which will waste twice as much seed and be half as accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for us, like after we've started, you know, you don't have to get everything, like, but even if you have a 1-row Jang seeder opposed to an earthway seeder, mm-hmm. like that's a huge upgrade. And then after you're using that Jang seeder, you have something that's really consistent, really reliable. Then you can like assess if you want the 5-row.
Yeah.
Jang seeder,
which is five times the amount of money,
which is five times the amount of money, but just starting with something that's really good at first.
Yeah.
Starting with something that's good. Like I'm trying to think of another example. I don't know if I can really like, but it's just like in a propagation house, like, you know, I think we were talking about like temperature controls or something. And
yes.
Just like these things that it's like, oh, well we can get away with that, with not having that. And it's like, don't try
yeah.
and get away from, because you can only get away for not having so many things before you just start making big mistakes.
Well, yeah. And so one of the things I commonly harp on is farm monitoring systems. So,
yeah.
You know, Robert, my friend who installs them, you know, they had a situation where they left the door in their washing shed open and they mm-hmm. had exposed PVC pipe in a minus 20 degree night.
Mm.
And if they hadn't had that system all of a sudden just go off and say, uh-oh, you got a problem down there, they would have been jackhammering concrete to put new pipes in.
Yeah.
And that's not cheap.
No. I made the biggest mistake I think I've ever made was last year. And we were trying to monitor the temperature without a heater in our greenhouse. And we were using all this plastic to keep like all mm-hmm. the tomatoes and peppers like warm. And we were trying to like hit it at a specific temperature. Like, okay, like we're going to wait and we're going to like keep checking until it gets to like 70 degrees. And then we're going to take that extra layer of plastic off in the low hoop.
Yeah.
Tunnel.
Okay.
Oh, and then we got so busy transplanting and we were like transplanting and out there like dee 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 dee. And I was so glad that it was my responsibility that week.
Yeah.
We alternate between me and the assistant farm director in the propagation house. And it was like 2:00 and I was like, oh,
yep.
Oh, I just like put my head up and I was like, oh my God, I didn't open that. And I like sprinted up there and I killed all of them. Like in just a couple hours, I just like lifted up the plastic and I looked in and I was like, oh, and I just yep. like shut it really quickly. And I was like, no, like, just like,
yeah,
I mean, and that's like not even like, I mean, I could harp on myself and be like, oh, that was such a bad mistake. I'm such a bad farmer. But it's like anybody in any year of experience, I think, could make that mistake. Like you get busy, you get pulled in all sorts of directions. Mm-hmm. And like, that was such a, it was such a bad thing to have happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what that made you realize is, okay, we have a system that's broken and yeah. you fixed that this year.
Yeah. Yes, we did. So I'm very excited. Yeah. And yeah. it was a good, you know, it's over and over again. It's good lessons, but hard lessons. Mm-hmm. To learn.
Well, it keeps us humble.
It really keeps us humble. And I was just like, I had to walk out there to like my farm crew and we had been like busting moves. We were doing so good, transplanting all these starts in like yeah. April and like, just like head hung low, like, man, you guys, I'm so sorry. Like I just killed all of the eggplants and all of the peppers. And mm-hmm. just like, yeah, I find that that like, maybe that's why, you know, we have a really good team dynamic too. And just like staying humble. And I hope that like, if I stay humble, it'll help other people, you know, just develop this culture of, you know, that we're all learning all the time. And uh-huh. that was a, yeah, that was a sad moment. I think, I was like crying.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then we yeah. move forward. Then it's like, okay, here we are. We have a plan. Let's move forward. So. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I remember that when we first started our greenhouse, the first year we had it, we had put tomatoes, because obviously you're going to start tomatoes super early. And so mm-hmm. we had started all these tomatoes in there, but because it was a 17 by 48, we only wanted to heat a very small portion of it. So we put uh-huh. a plastic wall in. Well, what we didn't realize is that if you run a heater in a very cold temperature in a very small space without an air intake, that you will actually kill your heater. Your heater will just go out.
Yeah.
And so we ended up putting the pilot out and frying, yeah, thousands of dollars worth of tomatoes. But that was one of those, we just didn't understand. And now it's one right. of those things. Okay, I understand how this whole thing works. You know, heater needs, you know, airflow.
Yeah.
But being a 16 or, you know, I think probably I was 18 at that time, sometimes you don't even read the directions. And it's a good, it's a good idea to read those directions and how to install a heater, because usually they're saying something important. So.
Yeah, I know. I need to learn that. I'm definitely not a direction reader. So
yes.
That's why I try and also hire people that do read directions.
Yes.
Yeah. That's another. Yeah. The other thing is that I think I've learned is to always be thinking of backup plans, like
mm-hmm. redundancy.
I have a lot of backup plans. Like, you know, we had a situation a couple of years ago that our propagation house was getting, it was just too cold and our potting soil wasn't a very good mix. We had changed it up and like, we just like didn't, our starts didn't grow at the, just like the right rate. They were just like simply not on track to be putting out in the field to be getting into our first CSA share. And so, you know, we can go over to the valley now and it's not like a really sexy thing to have to go plant starts from uh-huh. somebody else. But like, there's no shame in like, if things aren't working out at the bottom line, like just being humble and asking for help and going to those other people just in, you know, uh-huh. buying uh-huh. those plant starts. Or like last year, our peas got like, a bunch of our peas got eaten by gophers. So we had to buy some peas in, you know, from another farm. And like, oh, the CSA isn't just our farm. It's like, it's okay.
It's yeah. okay.
And that takes so much pressure off of me to have those plans in place and to just be like willing to know that things are adaptable and that like at the end of the day, some people could be like, okay, well, we're not going to get peas or we're only going to get a tiny amount of peas. And it's like, well, like maybe I can still keep that like integrity of our CSA share with like a crop that people really love and also support, you know, another farmer that has surplus in the area. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And for me, that just like takes that anxiety away. 'Cause for me, it's really important to have this, like, you know, really to have those peas in the share. You know, you know, everybody loves them.
Well, I think you just hit on something that I want to pull out, is that you can look at, there's two ways to look at that. One way is, oh my gosh, I didn't produce everything in this share and I'm feeling embarrassed about that. Or, oh, there's another opportunity to support another farmer in our community and just share their peas too. So I think so many people have that aspect, I got to produce everything. And I'm like, no, produce what you're best at.
Right. Yeah. And I've tried to, like, we're a market garden. And so last year we cut out potatoes, which are really fun to grow, but we cut them out because we could buy them from, you know, my friend that farms 80 acres and has a potato digger and does a really amazing job of that. And then we freed up enough space, you know, to grow 15 more food for 15 more CSA shares. And yeah, so that's, it's just really cool then too, to be able to like bring in some new things, mix it up, and just support other farmers.
Is there anything that new farmers should avoid their first year?
I don't know. I think it's just like trying to do too much, but you never know how much that is until you do too much, I think is the hard thing. I just think like starting too big would be something that would be really challenging.
Yeah.
Start small, build up, start with something that you're, you know, comfortable with, and, or it's probably not going to be comfortable at all if you're starting. Yeah.
Well, I think some people try to, like, I was talking to a guy today and he wants to do 2 acres this year. And he's still in startup mode. And I'm like,
yeah,
you need to be embarrassed by how small you're going to farm, because I know farmers that are friends of mine that are doing $300,000 in a single acre. I told him, I said, look,
right,
you do not need 2 acres to make a full-time living. You need a quarter acre and you need to focus on the right things and doing everything excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is really big, is just establishing your quality is really huge. There's so much competition that small farmers have to go up against now. And, you know, just with global agriculture and everything that you can get in a grocery store, like, we are really competing for that, with that quality and with that consistency. And until you really build up your customer base, like, over the time as we've built up our customer base and like kind of faith in our share and our business, can we then start, like, we're like, we're really sorry, the kale is really holy this week, you know, where maybe like our first years, like, we maybe wouldn't have done that. Or it wouldn't have been received as openly, but people are like, oh, well, that's part of it, because we're telling our story all the time through emails and they know. And, you know, it's, I think like that quality part is really just really important. And yeah. And just making sure that you're taking some time for self-care, however that looks.
You're right, because that burns you out just as much as having too much, not having time for self-care, and then working 80-hour weeks and then deciding I don't want to farm after 1 year.
Weird things happen.
So
I don't know.
If you could pick one, what would you say is your favorite farming tool?
The wire weeder from Never Sink Farms. It has like the quick changing attachment on it.
Yeah.
What is that? I forget what that is called, but,
You know who invented that?
Who?
I did.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, perfect. Well, that's my favorite thing.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. That is like huge for us. We just got like 4 of those and like the whole set of different weeders you can get for it, and just bust some serious moves with it. So
Elliot Coleman was the one who had the idea for the quick change head.
Oh, okay.
So we were the original design, brought it to Elliot, and then Elliot took it to the next level. So it was
cool
joint between the two of us. So
that's awesome. Yeah. But for our scale, you know, and I would have to also like throw in for us in Central Oregon, like Remay, we wouldn't be able to farm without Remay here, although it's a hate love relationship for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's never fun. it's so valuable, but it's never fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I may or may not have some Remay in my basement at the moment. So,
oh my gosh, we just built like a whole extra like shed thing for like Remay containment. So,
You recently took a 3-month intensive in Mexico. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I have always wanted to do like a Spanish language immersion program in Mexico or in Latin America. And I had lived down in Latin America, I think when I was like 21, I lived in Southern Chile for like 5 months. But it was just always something that I really wanted to do. And I was just like, man, if I get to like the point where I don't know, I've got kids and this business and all these things, and you possibly can't leave for 3 months. Then you get to where you're older and you're like looking back and you're like, man, that's something that I really wish that I had done, was take 3 months to go to Mexico. And, and so it really, I'd been planning it for a long time. I went down to Southern Mexico to Oaxaca and, spent like a month and a half living on the coast down there, and lived with two different local families. And it was a really, I just like loved it. It was really hard. It's really hard to not be able to speak to people.
Yeah.
Very like cohesively. And the funniest thing is that you can't, I didn't realize this, but like not being able to express who you are, kind of like going throughout the world and talking to people in a very formal way with the only language that you kind of know. And
yeah,
I have pretty strong facial expressions and stuff, so that was pretty good. I feel like people could like kind of understand, but yeah, it was just like a really, it was just something that I had wanted to do. And also I was able to tie it in with our work here. We work with a lot of the Latino communities, and we serve a lot of Latino communities at the food banks. So I was able to, I was fortunate enough to have a really supportive board that realized that, you know, my goals in life are also beneficial for the program, and that me learning Spanish would also be really great for our nonprofit, and was kind of able to weave multiple things together to make it happen. So I think one of my favorite experiences was I went to this little island that you had to get to but through a boat through like these mangroves through in, you know, for an hour. And I went for like two or three days. And then I just loved it there. And I just wanted to stay for longer. And I wanted to continue my Spanish program. And so I just started asking people if they knew anybody that could teach me Spanish.
Yeah.
And eventually somebody's like, yes, I know this woman. And they kind of like led me through this little village to the doorstep of this woman's house. And was like, hi, do you think you could teach me Spanish? And she's like, yeah, yes, I would love to do that. And we started talking, and she was also like a surf instructor. And then I was asking if she knew of any good place I could stay. And she had a room in her house that I could rent. And so I lived there with like her and her son for a while, and for like a month. And that was just really cool, and was able to connect also with the, with all the farming that they do there. And,
What kind of farming is predominant down there?
I would say, I mean, there's a lot of different crops, but it's getting to be pretty in, not like industrialized, but commercial. Like there's a lot of chemical use down there growing any type of crop. So that was really, but it was really interesting to see with the, they grew a lot of like sesame. I mean, Oaxaca is like this amazingly rich, state just in terms of their resources and their climate. So they can grow, you know, all the different types of corn. Squash is really big. But also all the brassicas, tomatoes. I did get a chance to visit some. I like sought out some small farms that I was able to connect with through Instagram and kind of like friends through friends. And so that was really cool to go down there and see some restaurants that had started their own farms and people doing some really cool things. So, yeah.
Very cool. So talk to us about what the next year holds. I mean, what are you thinking? Are you changing anything? You said you added the new heater for the greenhouse. Are there any other infrastructure?
You know, like the past 7 years, every year has been something like really new and really big. And we've grown the business. Like, I don't know. It's just grown every single year. And so, one thing, well, my plan was to like, just kind of stay where we are for a year and see really how well we can like hone in our systems and how efficient and how productive can we be with our crew at this size. My tendency is to kind of like grow. So this was a good little practice and just sitting for a year and just really looking at our systems. And, but one new thing that we're doing is we are taking over the management of the Sisters Farmers Market, which will be really new. And, we're taking that over from another organization and are going to hire like a market manager. And so really exciting about that, the farmers market in town. It's our first, last year was our first year that we did the farmers market. And I was like, not sure if we would be able to have enough or if it would go well, but it just went so well. And we're able to bring in quite a bit of revenue and serve a different, you know, people that couldn't sign up for a CSA share or some people that were just passing through town. And have just like this weekly kind of community event around food. So I'm excited and kind of like, you know, nervous about what that will entail.
Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Yeah. So let's see. Our website is a great starting point. And then I also was, I guess, one of the featured farmers on the Thriving Farmer Summit.
Okay. Yep.
I've had a lot of people reach out to me after they watched that. And I think I kind of talk about some more of the specifics of the farm, about the nonprofit component specifically. And Instagram is a really great, fun way to follow along at Seed to Table Oregon. And people can always email me with questions that they might have. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. And I absolutely know people are going to love listening to your story and just how you are kicking it in Oregon.
Yeah. Trying our best. We're just trying our best to stay alive and grow the vegetables out here. So it's been really good.
All right. Have a great rest of your night.
Thanks, Michael.
So there you have it, another episode in the books. So I'd love if you would hop on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. Those mean everything to us. We love to hear what you're thinking. If you have a podcast guest that you can recommend, please pop on over to the Thriving Farmer Podcast website and leave us a review. That's thrivingfarmerpodcast.com.